Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vaishlach. This week, Neiman Novitzki discusses Vaishlach. Neiman Novitzki is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Neiman Novitzki.
Thank you, Larry. In this week's Parsha, Parshat Vaishlach, we come to the end of the cycle of stories relating to Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov comes home from a long stay in the house of Laban and reunites with his brother Esav. At the end of the Parsha, we read of the genealogy of Esav, his descendants, and the kings that came from him. As such, I wanted to devote this podcast to looking at the character not of Yaakov, but of Esav. We'll be drawing three different portraits of Esav: the Midrashic portrait, a portrait drawn by Rav Hirsch, and a portrait drawn by Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, the grandson of Rashi. The three different portraits each pick up on the different stories that are detailed about the life of Esav in Tanakh. Four stories in all, none of which give us a total portrait of who this person is, but rather hints to what his character might have been like. The three stories are his birth itself and his profession. Okay. Later on, the story of the taking of the Nezira Dashim and the selling of the birthright, the story of the taking of the blessing, and finally, the story of the reuniting that comes up in our Parsha. I want to start with the portrait drawn in Midrash. This is a portrait that I think is perhaps the most famous portrait of Esav, Esav the villain. The Midrash paints Esav black from the womb. Picking up on the very first verse that we know about Yaakov and Esav, the pregnancy of Rivka, we read, "Vayitrotzitzu habanim b'kirba." When Rivka was pregnant, the fetuses in her womb were running around, the pasuk tells us. And the Midrash asks, what does that mean? Rabbi Yochan Omer, "Zeh ratz laharog et zeh, v'zeh ratz laharog et zeh." Already in the womb, Yaakov and Esav are fighting, one trying to kill the other. They give a second opinion. B'sha'ah shehayta omedet abatei knesiot abatei midrashot, Yaakov mefaches latzet, u'b'sha'ah shehayta overet abatei avodat kochavim, Esav ratz u'mefaches latzet. The second opinion brought in the Midrash is that whenever Rivka would pass the house of a Beit Midrash, a house of learning, Yaakov would be running around in her stomach trying to get out. On the other hand, whenever she would pass a house of idolatry, a house of idolatrous worship, Esav would be running around in her stomach trying to get out. According to the Midrash, Esav is not only evil, but he's evil even pre-birth. They continued this line of thought throughout almost every single sentence and story that we're told about Esav. At birth, we're told that Esav was an admoni, that he was either reddish or red-haired, but Bereishit Rabbah reads into that something a bit more sinister. Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, ki ilo shofech damim. Why is he red? Because it's as if he's already spilling blood. Again, it seems that his evil is innate, inborn. Already at the moment of birth, there's something bloodthirsty about him. The Midrash continues looking at the description of Yaakov and Esav as they grow up. The Psukim tell us, Vayigdilu ha-ne'arim vayhi Esav ish yodea tzayid ish sadeh, v'yakov ish tam yoshev ohalim. And the boys grew up, and Esav was someone who knew how to hunt, a man of the field, and Yaakov was an innocent person or a pure person who sat in the tent. Once again, Bereishit Rabbah tells us, what does this pasuk mean? Esav haya ish yodea tzayid, tzare tebriyot b'fiv. Esav was a hunter. What does that mean? And he trapped creation in his mouth. What does it mean to trap creatures in his mouth? That Esav was a trickster. He was someone who would try to trick people with his mouth, in the sense that he was a hunter, not just that he killed animals, but that he hunted people, he trapped people. In contrast, they say, what does Yaakov ish tam yoshev ohalim mean? What does it mean that Yaakov was a man of the tent? Shnei ohalim beit midrashol shel shem ubeit midrashol shel iver. Yaakov, on the other hand, was someone who dwelled tents of learning. Okay, here too, the Midrash is contrasting the brothers, making one white and one black, going way beyond the simple sense of scripture and extrematizing each side. Okay. Esav is not just a hunter, but he's someone who traps people. It's part of his personality. Yaakov, on the other hand, isn't someone who just happens to dwell in a tent, but he's someone who is learning in a tent. Part of the motivation for this specific learning of the Midrash, I think, comes from a lack of parallelism in the initial verse. By Yaakov, we seem to have one phrase that describes him and his personality. He's an ish tam, what kind of person he is. And then another phrase that perhaps describes what he does. He's a yoshev ohalim. By Esav, on the other hand, we had two different phrases, both of which, in the initial read, seem to refer to his profession. He's an ish yodei atzayid, he's someone who knows how to hunt. He's an ish sadeh, he's a man of the field. The Midrash is bothered both by that doubling of his profession and by the lack of parallelism between the two halves. And so what they do is reread the words ish yodei atzayid and say, this is not another repetition of the description of his profession, what he does, but it matches the description by Yaakov as an ish tam. Yaakov there, that was a description of his personality. He's a person who's innocent, who's pure. Thus, the words ish yodei atzayid by Esav must also be not just a description of his profession, but rather a description of who he is in his essence, what kind of a person he is. He is a person who traps others. He's a trickster. To give an example of just how far they go, the Midrash in Tanhuma talking about Esav's relationship with his father and questioning, why does his father love Esav? Why does Yitzchak prefer Esav? Why does Yitzchak want to give the brachot to Esav? Attributed to this very trickster aspect of his personality. And they give an example and they say, Kashehaya Esav ba min hachutz, haya omer la'aviv, Abba, hamelach mashet tehe chayav b'maser. When Esav would come home from being outside, he would come to his father and he would ask him all sorts of questions to let his father think that he was a good, observant Jew who cared about even the minutia of halacha, and asked his father, do I have to tithe the salt? Even about salt he would care about, in the eyes of Yitzchak at least. Yitzchak, seeing this, would say, look how my son is so exacting in his keeping of the mitzvot. It says, but really, lokach, mitoch dvarim elu hayat sado b'fiv. Really, Esav was not such a tzaddik, according to the Midrash, but rather, this is the way that he trapped his father with his mouth. So the Midrash is consistent throughout in reading Esav negatively, and saying that he's the kind of person who, from the moment of conception, was negative, was someone who wanted to go and do avodah zarah, wanted to go and do idolatry. He's admoni, he's bloodthirsty. He's someone who is a yodei atzayid, not a hunter, but rather a trickster. This moves into other stories as well. When we get to the story of the sale of the birthright, though one might easily say it is Yaakov who's a culprit in this story, the Midrash manages to paint Esav as the negative character of the story. They do so in two different ways. First, they read the verse, Ve'avo Esav min hasadeh v'hu ayef. The opening of that story is that Esav is returning from the field and he's tired, he's thirsty, he's famished. Okay, the simple understanding, of course, of that is that he's been out hunting, he comes home, he's tired, and that's why he wants to eat from the lentil stew. The Midrash, though, says, why is he so tired? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Chamesh Averot Avaro Torah Shabbo Tohayom. Five different transgressions did Esav transgress on that day. Baal Nara Morasa, Vaharaget HaNefesh, Vakafar Beikar, Vakafar Betchiyat HaMetim, Veshatet HaBechora. Okay, amongst the five, they include the three big ones, the ones that we say are the most serious transgressions that one could do in the area of sexual impropriety, in killing people, and in not believing in God. Okay, so they say he had a very busy day, and a very tiring day, doing all sorts of negative things. Okay, more in line, though, with the words of the story itself, they read into Esav's dismissal of the Bechara, his willingness to go and sell the birthright, something negative about Esav's character. When the Pasuk tells us that after Esav sold the birthright, Vayivez Esav et ha-Bechara, Esav belittled the birthright or dismissed the birthright, the Rashi writes, and he's drawing on the Midrash, He'id ha-katuv arisho shabiza avodato shel makom. Says, the text here is testifying to the cruelty, or not the cruelty really, the evilness of Esav, that he's belittling worship of God. Rashi's reading the birthright to include not just a double inheritance monetarily and financially of whatever Yitzchak had, but rather that the birthright included the right to serve God. And if so, he says, the fact that Esav didn't appreciate such a task, that Esav was willing to sell such a task, tells us something about Esav. He's someone who couldn't care less about God. He's someone who did not value the worship and service of God, and that paints Esav as the negative character in the story. Okay? Ramban reads something else negative in Esav's dismissal of the birthright, not that he's dismissing God, but rather something about his inherent personality. He says, after eating and drinking, finishing this lentil stew, Esav goes back to the field. And this is the reason that he belittled the Bechora. He says that he's like one of those idiots who only thinks about the moment, who never thinks about what will come tomorrow. Ramban reads into Esav's dismissal and selling of the birthright a type of personality who lives in the moment, who lives for the pleasures of the moment, who can think about, I'm hungry now, therefore I want this food right now, forgetting about the larger ideals in life and dismissing them, not thinking about what the future will hold. Finally, when we get to our last story, the story from this week's Parsha of the brothers meeting, okay, once again we see how the Midrash paints Esav black. When the messengers of Yaakov go and greet Esav, they see that Esav's coming to greet them, and Rashi writes in that pasuk, when they say, Banu el achicha l'Esav, we've come to your brother Esav, Shahayita omer achihu, aval hu nohegimcha ke'esav harasha. Rashi says, when Yaakov sent to his brother, he sent to Esav messengers and viewed Esav as a brother. But, hu nohegimcha ke'esav harasha, the messengers come back and they say, Esav doesn't view you as a brother. He sees you not as his brother, but as his enemy. Odeno bisinato, Esav still hates Yaakov. Okay? Now, that, of course, is really, when you think about it, a very natural feeling of Esav to still hate his brother. After all, his brother has deceived him and has taken the blessing from him, etc. But the way Rashi words it is as if Esav is all to blame. Esav is still a Rasha when you, on the other hand, are willing to see him as a brother. The Midrash Agadah goes a step further. Later on in the story, when the two actually meet, the pasuk tells us that they kissed each other, right? And it says Vayishakehu, but in the Masoretic text, there are certain dots on top of the word Vayishakehu, and the Midrash asks, Lama Nakud, why is it dotted? Milamid shelo bikesh linashko, ela linashacho. The Midrash learns out from these dots on top of the letters that there must have been something insincere about this kiss. When there are dots on top of the letter in ancient manuscripts, that often was a way of erasing the word. So here the idea is erase the word to kiss. It must not have been a real kiss, but rather when Esav went to kiss his brother, he wasn't trying to kiss him. He was trying to bite him and trying to kill him in that kiss. So what we have here is this initial portrait of Esav as Esav Harasha, Esav the villain. Every single line of the biblical text is reread to see negativity in Esav. And we have to ask why. What makes the Midrash read all of that into Esav? And I think the answer on the simplest level is because in the end, what do we know? Yaakov was the one that was chosen. No matter how you read Esav or how you read Yaakov, in the end, it is Yaakov who becomes the father of our nation. And the Midrash is looking, well, that must mean that there's something about Esav that made him be dismissed. And if so, it must have meant that he was not a good person. I think in addition, the very twinship of Yaakov and Esav makes it very easy to contrast them. And if you're going to want to paint Yaakov positively because he's the father of our nation, the sort of necessary correlation is to paint Esav negatively. One last connection, I think, is the identification of Esav with Edom. Esav becomes the father of the nation Edom, who later plays a role in Chorban Bayit Rishon, plays a role in the destruction of the temple. Not that they actively destroyed the first temple, but we're told in Tehillim that they rejoiced as the temple was destroyed. That already starts to see a negativity in Edom. And of course, later on, the Midrash connects Edom with Rome, those that are responsible for the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. For all those reasons, I think, they see Esav, the individual, as the precursor to Esav equals Edom equals Rome, has to be negative. From there, let's turn to a second portrait. The portrait that I think is laid out by Rav Hirsch, which we might call Esav the Misunderstood. Rav Hirsch also sees Esav as a negative character, but he says that it's not Esav's fault, but rather the fault of his parents. He starts off by pointing out that Tanakh doesn't refrain from pointing out the weaknesses and the frailties and the mistakes of its characters. And he says, and to some extent, the story of Yaakov and Esav is a case in point. He writes, Hanigud ha'amok shebein nechte Avraham, mikoro ha'ikari haya lo rak bitchunotehem, elagam b'chinucham halakoy. He says the big opposition, the big contrast that we see between the grandchildren of Avraham, meaning between Yaakov and Esav, its source is not just their individual character traits, but rather in their lacking education. He says, "Kol od hayuktanim lo samu lev lehevdelei netiyoteim hanisterot." He says, when they were younger, their parents, meaning Rivka and Yitzchak, did not pay attention to their different character traits, didn't realize that the two of them are quite different people, and therefore Torah achad v'chinuch achad haniku l'shneim, and therefore they taught them the same way, ignoring the differences in who they were. They acted as if the two of them were the same type of person who needed the same type of nurturing, the same type of education. And Rav Hirsch points out that that's not true. Yaakov and Esav were different characters, had different needs, had different interests, had different ways of looking at the world. And as such, they needed to be taught differently. He points out that later on, when Yaakov blesses his children, he realizes that he has different types of children. He has 12 different shvatim. And he points out that lo ra'a rak kohanim amore hara'a, he saw in them not just Levites and teachers. He didn't assume that all 12 of his children are capable and are right for the same type of a task. So instead, hine amad sham shevet ha-leviya, v'shevet ha-mlucha, shevet ha-sochrim, shevet ha-ikarim, v'shevet ha-luchamim. But instead, he recognized that the different tribes each had different character traits and different strengths. One would, yes, become the Levites, but another would become kings. Another would become merchants, others farmers, and others warriors. Amad sham lenegid einav ha'am kulo im kol sgulotav. He was able to see in front of him, in front of all, in his 12 children, the entire nation with all of their different unique talents and things that they had to contribute. He points out that in contrast, Rivka and Yitzchak weren't able to see the differences between their Yaakov and Esav. They weren't able to see that what Yaakov was good at was not the same things that Esav was good at, but that Esav also had things that he could have contributed, and they just had to nurture those things in him the correct way. He points out, Hamoshivet Yaakov ve'Esav al safsal limudim achad. Anyone who would have seated both Yaakov and Esav on the same learning bench, ubotam hergalei hachayim, and give them the same ways of dealing with life, and teaches them and educates them on the same path, he says, it's ensured if you do such a thing that one of them is going to be ruined. One of them is going to be corrupted because you need to teach chanoch lanar api darko. You have to teach each one according to who he is. He suggests that perhaps Yitzchak and Rivka should have figured out how Yaakov and Esav could have complemented each other. Yaakov with what he was good at, Esav with what he was good at. And if so, we might have had a very different nation, one who combined the strengths of the warrior inside Esav, the hunter aspect of Esav, and the good learning and the spirituality of Yaakov, and somehow combined them. But he suggests, by forcing Esav into a certain mold that he didn't fit into, Esav ends up turning on them. And that's part of what leads, he suggests, to Esav's negative characteristics. Okay, I think this is a really interesting portrait of Esav. One who, yes, views Esav black and definitely does view him in the end as having become a rasha, but suggests that Esav didn't have to turn out that way. but rather it's because of the way his parents treated him, the way that his parents didn't see what he had to offer, that that was the reason that he became what we call Esav HaRasha. I want to move into a third portrait, a portrait drawn by Rashbam, which views Esav not negatively at all, but rather as a somewhat neutral character. And here it's actually interesting to see Rashbam sort of work line for line with the same psukim that the Midrash had earlier worked off of, but read them in a very different way. So, for example, in the description of how the boys are born and how they're conceived and how they're fighting inside their mother's womb, so he reads Vayit Rotsutsu when they're running around. He says, what are you reading into this? That one's running into the house of Avodah Zarah and one's running towards learning. No, this is just the way that fetuses are inside a mother's tummy. They move a lot. And when you have twins, it feels like abnormal movement. Okay. Later on the verse Yodea Tzayid, which we had said before in the Midrash reads as Yaakov being a trickster, he says, no, Latsud Tzayid Lahavi. All this pasuk is coming and telling us is that he's a hunter. He's someone who goes out and finds all the different food that's outside. In contrast, Yoshevo Halim, the description of Yaakov as a person who dwells in tents, he says, in contrast to the Midrash that reads it as he's learning in the tents of Shem and Aver, he says, Ro'et Son Aviv, he's a shepherd. For Rashbam, that whole initial description of Yaakov and of Esav is neutral on both sides. Yaakov does not become a very special person who's going to learn Torah from in utero, nor is Esav an evil person who wants to run after idolatry in utero. Similarly, when we get to the story of the selling of the birthright, where the Midrash had read into Esav's actions a certain denigration of God in belittling the birthright, or perhaps a certain living in the moment and reading Esav as someone who doesn't care about the future, Rashbam reads Esav very differently there too. He says, why did Esav belittle the birthright? Why was he willing to go and sell his birthright? In the pasuk, it tells us that Esav says to his brother that, Hine anochi holech lamut, lama li habechorah? I'm going to die. What do I need the bechorah for? Rashbam understands, what does it mean, I'm going to die? Not that he's going to die right now of hunger, and therefore he's willing to sell his birthright, because if not, he's going to die of starvation at this moment. But rather that what Esav was saying is, I'm a hunter. There's a very high likelihood that I'm going to die before my father because of the nature of my profession. It's a dangerous profession. And if I'm going to die before my father, well, then I'm never going to benefit from the inheritance anyway. So I might as well sell my birthright. For Rashbam, Esav is not the paziz character, the person who just is acting on his whims and going and saying, well, I want the pleasures of the moment. But he's someone who actually said to himself a very logical conclusion. Is a birthright worth something to me or not? No, it's not, because I'm very likely to die beforehand. Okay, so again, a very different Esav, a much more neutral character. Not necessarily positive, but not negative in the slightest. When we get up to the last story, the one about the reunion in our parsha this week, Rashbam writes, when the messengers came to meet Esav and they say, Banu el achicha Esav, he says, and the messengers tell Yaakov, Umatzata chein be'inav kasher amarta. He says, and you have found favor in the eyes of Esav, as you said. V'hinehu mitoch shesamach b'viyatcha u'bahavato otcha, holech l'kratcha v'arba me'ot ish imo. He says, and Esav is coming to greet you with 400 men in order to honor you from his love of you. Now, almost everybody reads instead in opposition to Rashbam that when Esav is coming with 400 men, they assume Esav is coming to fight against Yaakov. And that, of course, is how Yaakov understands Esav's actions as well. But Rashbam suggests, no. Esav was actually coming with love in his heart. He's coming to greet Yaakov and to honor him with 400 people. It's just Yaakov who doesn't have enough faith to see that. Yaakov, even though he hears this, is nonetheless frightened, and thus he acts upon that fear. Okay, where does Rashbam get that from? So the truth is, as we read before, in the end of the story, is that when the two actually do greet, the pasuk tells us, Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. Rashbam says, don't read into that like the Midrash does, that this isn't a sincere kiss. Vayishakehu means he kissed him. Esav came with love in his heart. He had forgiven his brother. He no longer hated him, and he actually wanted to just simply honor him with 400 men. And he comes in full emotion and hugs and embraces his brother at the end of the story. So what we have for Rashbam is a very different Esav. An Esav who there's no negativity to, who is someone who's able to forgive his brother even after he felt that he had taken the brachot from him, that he perhaps had tricked him into selling his birthright, etc. Someone who doesn't just live in the moment, but actually might have thought through what he was doing and come to a logical conclusion as to why he should be acting one way or the other. And of course, this leaves us just with one question. The Esav that Rashbam paints is an Esav that comes out of the Psukim, a simple reading of the Psukim without reading anything into it. But it doesn't answer the question, if so then, well, why was Esav not chosen to be the leader? And I think to answer this question, we might have to go back to some of Rav Hirsch's assumptions. Rav Hirsch suggests that in the beginning, Esav wasn't negative either. He and Yaakov were just different. And that's in essence how Rashbam views them. Yaakov and Esav are just different characters, okay? Each one is a fine character, might have some negative qualities, might have some positive qualities like anybody else. But what we might suggest is that perhaps Esav was not necessarily the Esav HaRasha as painted by Midrash, but perhaps was much more of the neutral Esav as painted by Rashbam. But nonetheless, he wasn't the right person to lead the Jewish nation. Perhaps he was dismissed not because he was a cruel person, not because he was a bloodthirsty person, but rather because he just wasn't the right person. He had good qualities. He might have been a great hunter, but those were just not the qualities that were looked for in the leader of Am Yisrael. So with this review, I hope that you have several different ways of looking at Esav now, and perhaps you can mix and match some of them, but that whichever portrait you choose is the one that you think speaks to you the most, I hope that the different ways of looking at Esav have opened your eyes to the character and helped you think about him. In new ways. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Neema. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.